This is part two of 10 things that matter more than you think in climbing performance. Hopefully you've listened to part one and have gone through the five things on that and have understood the whole idea and reason why I wanted to put together this little mini solo podcast or rant, because I feel like there's a number of things in climbing which really make a big difference, but often don't get talked about enough or are understood fully or are experimented with, or that there's education around these items, but they make a really, really big difference when it comes to getting your project done, and sometimes even affects the training that you're doing. And that's why I wanted to go through these things to give you what I think they are and how they break down. So the factors that their constituent parts, essentially, and then also some actionable items that you can go away and put into place in your own climbing practice or training practice or how you approach your projects. And as I said in part one, I promise you that if you really deal with even, let's say, 3 out of 10 and really get stuck into making a difference on these, it will have a big, significant impact on your performance. I'm very, very confident in saying that if you went to a group of the 100 of the world's best climbers, whether they were sport climbers, comp climbers, boulderers, they will have ticked off most of these 10 items and they will do them well. But they're not easy to spot. You don't see them easily when you're at the crag because they kind of go under the radar. So in part one, I went through 5 topics: shoes, skin quality, humidity and wind speed, the full warm-up in caps lock, and visualization. If you want to go and check out and learn more about those, go to part one. You can find those on our normal podcast channels. But now I'm going to go into part two and go through the next 5 items that I think really matter and make a big difference. So number 6, this one is all about hip positioning. And I want to be clear in saying that I consider hip positioning as being something which is both static and mobile. So perhaps you could call it use of hips, maybe. That would be a broader term. And this comes down to how close can you get your hips or your center of gravity into the climbing wall surface? How far left can you move it? How far right? How much can you move it up and down with those far extremities of leftwards or rightwards movement? And then also combined with that, how you throw those hips or that center of gravity around. How much momentum can you carry? Can you arc that momentum? So can you move that momentum through that plane of climbing in a totally straight movement, or can you bring it from being low and wide out from the wall to really close into the wall through the mid part of a movement to then arcing out at the end? So really the whole concept is, can you do lots with your hips and can you do it well? Hopefully the answer is yes, I can do lots, but if it's not, and you don't feel that that's something which is a true superpower or something that you really excel in at the moment, I think it's really important to get on top of, because it massively affects climbing efficiency and movement execution. And a lot of the key to this, aside from climbing, just being good at climbing movement and improving your skills, is how flexible you are. And if I was to be very broad about the climbing population, I would tend to score most female athletes as being on the high end of what they do with their hips, whether that's their positioning or how they actually use them in terms of the momentum, the throw. And most men, and this is really broad and generic, so you can definitely call me out and saying I've seen people either side of it, and for sure you do see that, but the men will be a lot lower. And this for us at Lattice also plays back into this factor that we see with finger strength models, how the female population will for the greater part, have a much lower absolute finger strength score for the same grade metric, and men will have a much higher one. And a lot of this comes down to this flexibility element and how you use your hips. So one, get flexible. It's not that hard to start some kind of flexibility routine and build it into your training and really take it on. Don't just go, oh, I'll do it for 4 weeks. I'll do it for 8 weeks. Because just like any form of training, it goes again if you don't start working it. Look at the elite and look at what they're doing with their flexibility, and they're consistently working it. And I think the best area and where does this best is in the competition scene. And they're always doing their flexibility work, but they're great climbers. The next in combination with that is getting strong through the entire range of motion. And this will be, I suppose, naturally part of a good flexibility mobility training regime, that you become strong through this entire range of motion. But it is somewhat useless if you can't actually use the end ranges of your flexibility if you're too weak to do so. So make sure it's strong and it's flexible. And then lastly, is get into the practice of filming yourself and watching what you do with your hips or your center of gravity when you're climbing, because you might be quite surprised at how inefficiently you're using them or how differently you're using them to others. It's especially good if you can film yourself and then compare yourself to others who are getting up some of these problems and seeing the differences of what you're doing your hips. It's a very interesting exercise, and I would thoroughly recommend that you get into a habit of doing it. You can do it the way on the wall, you can do it the crag. It's super simple. The next factor is ladders and dogging tactics. And what I mean by this is how you break down both boulders and sport climbs. And yes, working a boulder isn't just about ladders, and working a sport route isn't just about dogging. But it sort of encapsulates the idea that a good strategy for breaking down and red pointing and working a project is also very key to doing well and performing at the top end. So it's things like ladders. Even collapsible ones are great for going out bouldering, because they're quite mobile and you can walk them in a lot easier, and you can change the length, especially for steep stuff. Ab ropes, or rappelling in and trying the moves or trying the holds or brushing them properly rather than just being on a stick on the end of a pole. Getting on a spotter's shoulders and getting lifted up to feel the holds, to starting higher up. Dogging with a clip stick and actually taking a short mini clip stick on the route, just to save yourself the energy when you're on the route and you're not just climbing through sections three or four times just to get to the next bolt to dog on it. Clipping in tight when you're on a steep route. So when you've clipped that bolt above you, you lower down ever slightly and then clip back into the rope with a quick draw, really short. Because people will try and use their legs or their arms and they'll hook them around the rope. And that just uses energy. Again, getting a little power pull from the rope on a tight rope above you when you're on a relatively vertical sport route. Just get your B layer to crank down on the rope, almost be in a hanging position. And it'll take two to maybe 5, maybe even 10 kilos of pressure off your harness to make you feel lighter and help you through that move. It's almost like a power spot. They're all really good tactics and things that people will use at the top end very, very effectively. So what I'd recommend you do is go to the crags and watch what the pros or the elite do. Watch what tools they use, what strategies they use. I remember going to a sport climbing crag in Spain, Santa Linia, which had, you know, it's got so many 9As, 9A pluses, 9B. The elite is just some of the world's best climbers there. And watching a fellow British climber, Alex Barrows, climb and start to work on a 9A there, I couldn't believe the number of efficiencies he had in terms of dogging the route. And he just basically didn't waste any energy at all. Clip sticks were out, getting short up above the bolt, clipping in hard, never pulling on a thing when he didn't need to. And this really comes down to the concept that if you want to get good at this, think about in every moment when you're at the crag, whether you're working your boulder or working on your sport route, am I using energy right now that isn't working on climbing movement? And if the answer is yes, think about whether you can get rid of that. That's all it comes down to. So if you're vigorously brushing away in a really cramped up, core intensive position on a boulder just to try and get that hold in the perfect condition, can you find a different position from which to brush to so you don't waste that energy? Can you wrap in from the top and just do it off a harness? When you're on a route and you're trying that move, which seems so much harder because you're sketched out because you're above the bowl and you're not yet relaxed on the route and you're over gripping, just get a clip stick out and clip above you so that you can relax to at least work the route. There's so many things that you can do on this. So think of it about it as if you're using effort and it's not for climbing, you got to try and get rid of it. It's amazing how many things you can get rid of if you're really, really strict about this. You do have to chat to your partners a little bit though, because some of this can mean that they have to put some kind of effort. So it's a compromise, but it's very effective. And I see a lot of people at the top end doing it. Next one is one last go. So many people over the years that I've climbed with, watched, belayed, have done their projects on the last go of the day. Stick around and make sure you're trying, even when sometimes it all seems hopeless. I can't tell you how many times even in articles I've read it occasionally, or seen it in videos where people have said, oh, I was just going up the route to get my quick draws back, and suddenly they've done it. It's all about getting into that zone, which enables you to work on that mentality that anything can happen, or anything can happen when you're operating right at your limit. And what I mean by this is the more that you practice and refine the state management, or how your mind-body flow is, or mind-body connection is working in that state, the better you get at doing that thing. And if you're always getting to that point where you go, yeah, I'm slightly tired, or I'm not feeling 100% anymore, or you know what, it probably isn't happening today, you never get that chance to refine that part of your process of operating right at your limit. And that's where time and time again, we've seen people actually do their thing. So you almost have to just look at the patterns around you and go, well, if people are ticking things right at the end, when it's that last go of the day and they've kind of given up, there's something to be had in that. So my two actionable items for this is have a go at trying to be the last person to have a go at every session you have with your climbing partners. So when it looks like everyone is starting to kind of just round up for the day, meaningfully think, I'm going to be the last person to have the last go at the crag with my friends, or on the boulders when you feel like it's getting to the end. Be the person that always has the last go on that boulder. And yes, be careful that, you know, your skin's not destroyed, or you're feeling tweaky, or it's not the right time to go for it. This, of course, is the, you know, the caveat within this. But try and pick up that kind of habit, because you might start to sneakily get that kind of practice in. And then also get into the habit of trying things, or trying problems where you're 100% sure that you'll fail. Because by doing that, you get to, again, refine what it feels like operating in a zone where the setup comes with an expectation of failure. And I feel like this is an important mindset practice, and one that plays out to a lot of positives in the long run. It sounds risky, but actually getting comfortable with it and getting very experienced with that failure element is more beneficial than you think. And you see the pros and you see the elite do this. So we know it works. Number nine is power. Now, power, or strength rather, is somewhat useless without power. That execution of strength with speed, and in an efficient way that's actually sport specific. So we're not talking here about power in a gym where, in a weights gym rather than a commercial climbing gym. We're not talking about non-specific sport exercises. We're talking about executing power on a climbing surface. So many climbers nowadays, especially because the training knowledge is out there and there's a lot of system board climbing going on, there's a lot of fingerboard going on. There's a lot of strength and conditioning work that might be working just basic strength rather than power. People are getting too practiced and too refined and too comfortable with that strength element, where we've got a much lower speed or velocity through that range of motion. Being able to move fast, but at a lower load, so less, a lower percentage of your run, one rep max, is really important. This is the stuff, which is the magic, which happens when you actually send. Because inevitably, on the very hardest things, you do have to execute with some form of power, and you need to execute with a degree of speed, because you can't do it statically and you can't do it slowly. So practice and refine your power. Just, I keep saying this every time I go down to the wall or I go out to the crags, too many slow, static, I guess I'd say almost boring looking climbers who don't move with a little more speed. It worries me. And I think it needs to be practiced and it needs to be refined. So one, get into the practice of adding in some form of power training into every session during peak cycles. Power training, like all forms of training, takes a degree of consistency and frequency all the way through a training cycle to see the results from it. So you do need to include it in a frequent sense at the right time of the year. For me, that's in a peak cycle, because we want to use the strength that we've developed during foundational periods and then use that during a peak. So make it frequent in those climbing and training sessions. And then secondly is try projects, whether that's sport, boulder, trad, that you can't do statically. You know that it's too difficult or doesn't work in a static manner. Get dynamic and get working on projects which actually force you to do that, because it'll surprise you that one, you'll actually get up them and you'll develop the power. And two is that if you're in a complementary sense, you're doing that preparation work in your training sessions that goes with it, you'll see the results. You'll get that feedback cycle, which will be like, yeah, this feels great. I'm feeling psyched. I did my power training sessions. I'm seeing improvements. And now it's playing out my projects. I love this. I'm going to incorporate more power training into my climbing. And the whole thing will just spin out into it being a positive feedback loop. So really recommend that. Okay, last one, number 10. And I feel like maybe I've left one of the most important ones right till the end. And that's supportive partners. So that could be a spouse or a boyfriend, girlfriend. It could be a climbing friend. It can sometimes also be a coach as well, depending on your coaching relationships and how much those people are involved with your own development. And a climbing partner is a true superpower, as they provide so many things that can be productive and effective for your performance. Admittedly, they can also be problematic if you get the wrong types of partner. So I don't want to say here, just get a climbing partner, they'll solve everything, because that's not true. You need the right types of partners. And that's why I put that supportive word with partners. So do be aware of that. But if you get supportive partners and ones that can really help and benefit your climbing, it's just amazing what you get out of it. I'm a classic example of this, that I've had Pete as an incredibly supportive climbing partner for what must be 12, 13 years now. And I think we've both very much benefited from each other's partnership in our climbing. And I don't think we would be quite where we are now without each other. And why it works is that it helps you have fun, and bringing fun and joy into your practice, your training, your crag sessions, your projecting is definitely a good thing. It helps when you're having to try hard and you have the setbacks and you want to get into a positive mindset or a productive mindset. They're great for feedback, whether that's verbal and they're telling you what to do and they're giving you things that they've spotted, as well as just holding a camera phone whilst you're trying to video yourself even. It's really, really useful for that feedback cycle. They also provide accountability so that they can say that, hey, you told me that a month ago you were going to do this, or you said that you were only going to have one more burn on this, or you said that you were going to miss that quick draw. to climb this sequence more efficiently. They're really, really useful for that as well. In terms of energy, if you get the right partner, they can really help with that, whether that's calming you down and reducing that kind of energy level or really amping you up. A right partner could put you into a great spot. You can also learn a lot from them. And this I see particularly with juniors and those who are a little bit earlier in their climbing careers, that people who manage to get in with a crew or climbing partners who are significantly more experienced than them as climbers or operate at better grades will tend to become the same grade as those around them. It's like grades just get absorbed by osmosis. And if you hang out with a V15 climber with enough frequency over 5 years, guess what? You kind of get dragged towards their grades. And whether it's a boulder or a sport climber, a trad climber, you really learn from them all their tactics, their training habits, how they operate, their mindset, their habits. It's just everything gets absorbed. So partners can be incredibly useful in terms of that sense. And the broader the range of partners that you have, of course, it's a greater resource for you. So I really can't overemphasize how important this one is and how much you can actually make your performance go up over the years by ticking this one and getting your supportive partner element just right. So go and hang out with people that are better than you, even if you're not friends with them or you're not in their group at the moment. Just be supportive to them. Hang out in the same places. Get talking to them. Yeah, you might not be able to try that same project or you might not be doing the same problems, but just socializing, you'll get to see this and you may well end up as being friends of them, but at least trial it. Don't think I've got to be over on my own on this part of the crag or at the gym because I don't know these people. Be sociable, get chatting, and you'll pick up more than you want and you might well pick up some new friends. And then also, go to projects that you aspire to do and go and check out whether there's other people working on them. Because again, you may find one, that person or people might be really supportive of another spotter or another pad that turned up, even if you're not trying it. And two is that you'll get to learn the beta. You'll get to see what they're doing with their skincare, their shoe choice, how much they're chalking up, how much power they're executing, how they're moving. There's so much that you can pick up from going and doing that by just hanging out your project. So if there's that V11 that you've always aspired to do one day, just go and be there. I've gone out a number of times now over the years to things which have had a random person or two people or three people just hanging out and observing and being spectators and being supportive. And they're great. I love it. You can get a spot from them. They'll move the pad around if it's a traversing problem. And I never have any problem with it. And I never see that as being any kind of issue. If people are cool and they're being respectful of other people's space, then it's a really cohesive, mutually beneficial arrangement and relationship. So go and do it. I promise you, you'll see benefits from it. So there you go. That is part two of the 10 things that matter more than you think in climbing performance. I hope you found this useful. Don't forget, these are actionable things, so you can go out and you can start to practice these in your climbing and training habits. As I said at the start, tick off 3 or 4 of these and be really, really good at them, and you'll see a big difference. But bear in mind that those at the top, those at the elite, tend to be pretty darn good at all of these. So really have a bit of time to reflect and feedback and think about whether you're ticking all of these and you've really got these nailed, because they make a difference. And if you can execute those on top of your training that you're already doing, your technique that you're already using, and also the psychology or the mindset that you're already practiced in terms of your climbing pathway or journey, you're going to be in a very, very strong position. We will see you again very soon. Don't forget, there's part one, and that one's on this podcast channel there. And thank you very much for listening.